welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
We love books so much that we almost didn't read this book.
We love books so much that we don't love books.
I actually spent most of the week watching Parks and Rec on Netflix instead of reading this book.
I spent a lot of time avoiding reading this book.
To be fair, I would recommend the show Parks and Rec to anyone who's interested.
Yeah, the fact that we are only 24 hours late is, we can ascribe solely to having technical difficulties with our last episode.
Yeah. I texted Ben and said, I don't think I'm ever going to finish this book. And he said, well, do you want to do a short story for Monday? And I said, we've already taken 2 weeks to read it. And neither one of us was even, like, halfway through it.
That's true. I had to power read over the weekend.
Yeah, I probably read, more than half of it in the past 4 days. So, yeah!
Woohoo!
We're so good at this.
We are so good at this.
That's why we have such a vast and sundry following.
Right, yeah. That's... That's why our followers number in the dozens.
You can set your watch by the time we update our podcast.
As long as your watch doesn't actually tell time.
So this week we read Catch 22 by Joseph Heller.
No.
Catch 22 is actually an incredibly popular phrase, not popular.
Oh, it's made it into the lexicon.
Yeah, it's in the vernacular, the common vernacular. So even if you haven't read the book, you've probably heard the phrase before.
Probably even have a vague idea of what it refers to.
Yeah.
It's just a contradictory statement, really.
Yeah, I think the first time they use it in the book is that if you are insane, then you can't fight. But if you don't want to fight, you can't be insane, therefore you have to fight.
Right. So I guess the only way to get sent home is if you're crazy and you resist being sent home kicking and screaming?
Yeah. Or if you get, like, chopped in half and they can send you home.
Except for your legs.
In a
those just sit on the those just sit on the beach and get ignored.
Yikes.
Whoa.
Yeah, for being really funny at parts, this book has some really scary, gruesome moments.
Well, it is a war book.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like one all the time until those things happen, and then you go, oh, shit.
Yeah.
So I think that's the other famous thing about this book, is that it is a classic war novel, and possibly the seminal war novel of this century, because it deals with all the modern issues of war, with the bureaucracy and all that stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, mainly the way the hierarchy works.
Yeah, if you write about the Civil War, or if you write about, you know, the Crusades or whatever, you're not writing this type of book.
No, well, that's because those seem to be all about, like, generalship and charismatic leaders. And World War II history, you definitely get some of that, but it's a lot more about logistics.
Yeah.
Which is actually interesting, but very different.
And I did read something that said Joseph Heller also based part of this off of the Korean War, which was more of a clusterfuck than World War II, and then just kind of applied some of those issues that happened during the Korean War to this book.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it's not necessarily only about World War II.
Well, if you were in Korea and you didn't want to be there, then, well, first of all, I wouldn't blame you, but second of all, I could see that better, especially since World War II was, like, the, at least in popular history, is, like, the great unifying nationalistic force in our country's history.
The good guys versus the bad guys.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it wasn't quite that cut and dry in the moment, but... certainly a lot more so than Korea.
Yeah. Or Vietnam.
Or Iraq.
Or, you know, any war that happened.
Basically, other than that one.
Before or since. Yeah. All right, so we've already covered the fact that it's a war story. It's also a satire, which we mentioned, but... The tone of the book overall is really one giant joke.
Yeah, it definitely is. It's very silly. It's very contradictory. There are many, many passages of a person describing something that they then flatly contradict a moment later.
Milo buying seven cent eggs and selling them for 5 cents a piece and making a profit.
And turning a profit. Because he's buying them for 1 cent and then selling them for three and a quarter cents.
Yeah, and then buying them for seven cents.
Yeah.
And then selling them for 5 cents. But then he's still making a profit.
But it's okay, because it goes to the syndicate and everybody has a share.
Those parts are just like, what? And then a lot of the conversations are so confused, they're almost impossible to follow.
That's true. The ones that hit really well, and the ones that don't are just muddled. It's really tough to read more in a chapter at a time in this book, as we discovered.
Yeah.
When I did my big chunk of reading on this one, I had to find something to do for 15 or 20 minutes between chapters.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only way I was able to keep going.
Yeah, I would force myself to read a chapter and then go, ooh, internet break.
Yeah, pretty much. Catching up on my Dragon Ball Z abridged.
Which surprises me, because I'm going to go ahead and say it. It was harder for me to read this book than to read Fifty Shades of Grey.
Oh, goodness. That definitely wasn't the case for me. This book I at least wanted to finish in some corner of my mind, even though I was doing everything in my power to avoid reading the book.
I think the thing is, I didn't try to avoid Fifty Shades. I was just like, whatever, I'll just read a bunch of vanilla porn in one sitting, and that's exactly what I did.
I was past that mindset at about the two-thirds mark, because it just kept going. The last 200 pages.
Let's just do this episode on how much we hated Fifty Shades of Grey.
Oh, I would do every episode on that. We could have the How Much I Hate Fifty Shades of Grey podcast. I could do an hour on that every week.
Well, you'd probably have to read the other two to make sure you had
it. It would probably not be worth it.
So back to Catch 22.
Oh, right.
What's our plot synopsis?
Was it, what is this? I don't even.
Yep.
There's no plot, guys.
No. We were trying to come up with a brief summary, but there honestly is not one. You can't. It's pilots during World War II, sometimes flying missions, sometimes having sex with prostitutes, and doing a lot of other insane shit.
And always being insane.
Yeah.
In different ways.
Yeah. Every single character makes no sense.
So, yeah, if you haven't read it, I can't do anything to help jog you along.
Yeah.
But maybe listen to this episode. You may not want to read it by the time we're done.
Yeah, and it might be enough to listen to the episode because the book's just joined it. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll find out.
So the setting is on Pianosa, which is an island off of Italy.
A real island.
Yeah. Though
apparently much too small to base like a bomber wing off of.
Yes, as Heller actually acknowledges before the book even starts.
Yeah.
And it's in 1943-44.
I think it bleeds over.
Yeah. So right in the thick of the war.
And the point of view is, well, it's third person for sure.
Uh-huh.
And it's not close.
No.
And it's not omniscient.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in between. I was dubbed it third person hot air balloonist. Like, someone has a good overhead view, but is still, like, within tether reach or something.
Yeah, because sometimes it really does focus around someone's thoughts and feelings, and then at other times it makes objective remarks about stuff going on, and you never really know.
Like, I guess you could round it up to omniscient because of that, but
I think it's just Milo narrating.
Yeah, it could be.
That man.
I like that theory. Since he apparently is running
in charge of everything,
both sides of the war in Europe single-handedly.
All right. Who is... But we do have a protagonist, despite all the disjointedness in the book.
Yeah, the story, such as it is, and the crazy happenings, generally revolve around Yossarian.
John Yossarian?
Yeah, the only reason I knew that is because it was, like, on the jacket or something.
Yeah. I think they call him John maybe twice.
Oh, I probably missed that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the other times they call him Yo-Yo.
Right. That made more sense to me. As a nickname.
I actually saw a play where the protagonist's name was Yossarian Yossarian.
Oh, yeah?
Because his parents liked Catch 22.
Oh, boy.
That was not a silly play, even though that's a silly premise for a name.
It's a good little joke. I like it.
But anyway, Yossarian, he is a bombardier.
And he doesn't want to be one anymore, is the gist of it.
He does not want to fly any more missions because he doesn't want to get killed.
They keep raising the mission cap.
He's going to live forever if it kills him, I think was the phrase. Yeah, so at the start of the war, they had to fly, what, like 30 missions?
40 maybe, but basically every time he gets close to the mission cap, it gets bumped another 5.
Yeah, the colonel in charge keeps bumping it up 5 because he's trying to distinguish himself from all the other squadrons.
Right.
So he's raising the mission count. Until at the end of the book, I think it's up to 70.
Oh, it was up to 8. Or, yeah, I think it was up to 70. And he was threatening to raise it to 80.
Yeah. That would really set me apart. But yes, understandably, Yossarian does not want to fly that many missions and potentially get shot out of the sky.
Yeah.
Right before the book starts, one of the characters has died pretty graphically, which is shaking Yossarian up a lot, I think.
Yeah.
You don't really find out until the end exactly what the hell was going on.
Exactly how graphic it was.
Yes. But, and the book kind of jumps around chronologically, too, but, yeah, I'm pretty sure it opens, like, right after that happened, because they're talking about the dead man in his tent that he won't get rid of.
Right.
Which is not actually a dead man, it's just the guy's stuff that he refuses to take out of the tent.
But the guy never was officially in the squadron, and so he basically arrived, dumped his stuff, went on a mission, died, and since he was never officially part of the squadron, they wouldn't officially muster him out, and they wouldn't give up his spot in the tent.
Uh-huh.
A fairly typical example of the type of bureaucracy that exists in this story.
Yes. That they make fun of quite a bit. What else about Yossarian? He falls in love with every woman he meets.
Yes, immediately. Against his will, sometimes, I think. He thinks everybody is crazy, including himself.
Mm-hmm.
He's almost the noble coward type of character.
Yeah.
Is that an archetype?
Shaggy and Scooby-Doo?
Maybe.
Do they count? Yossarian and Scooby-Doo.
He feels like he's done what he needs to do, and he doesn't want to get killed doing more of it when he doesn't have to. That seems reasonable to me.
And it's right, and like you were saying, how World War II is typically painted as, you know, the nationalistic rah-rah war, and then you have this guy who isn't rah-rah about the war and doesn't want to fight in it, which makes sense, but is pretty contrary to a lot of World War II stories where soldiers are fighting, you know, for the cause.
Right, and I'm sure there were plenty of soldiers who didn't want to be there.
Jesus, yeah.
There were a lot of draftees in that war.
I actually visited a friend over the weekend. She was telling me about her grandfather who fought in World War II, and he was in the European theater, and they were getting shot at in the forest one day. And the only reason he lived is because he just turned and ran away as fast as he could and accidentally fell into a foxhole and then just hid in the foxhole.
I don't blame him.
And then made it home, so, I mean,
I can't promise I wouldn't do the same thing.
I was like, good for him. I don't know. When I was a kid, I always thought, if I was involved in a war, I would just pretend to die and, like, lie down on the field of battle and then hope that someone wasn't going around, like, bayoneting bodies.
Well, as a kid, that doesn't even occur to you that might be a thing,
right? No. I'll just pretend to be dead. It'll be fine.
Because you get this, like, weirdly honorable view of warfare from culture, I guess. Which is fucked up in 19 different ways.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can't blame Usarian for feeling that way. he is, I guess he's kind of prone to fits of passion, but they're coming from weird places sometimes.
Yeah.
Down the stretch, the last couple chapters, and I guess really in the incident with Snowden for that matter, like, he's actually kind of trying to do the right thing.
Uh-huh.
He's trying to rescue a 12-year-old girl off the street who has no place to go, and he's trying to patch up this guy who's wounded despite being scared out of his mind, and he doesn't succeed in patching the guy up, certainly. And we don't know what happens with the kid, because...
Yeah, the book ends, and we don't really know.
Yep.
Right, and I was actually going to say, actually, his fits of passion down the stretch, too, really speak to his PTSD, because he goes from just getting pissed at people to literally trying to murder people.
True.
Without even really realizing what he's doing. And I thought that was a pretty good show that he's probably not really fit to fly anymore.
Yeah, he needs out of the war zone.
McWatt, his pilot buddy, makes the observation that, oh, I always thought you were just lying about that stuff or over-exaggerating. It's like, no.
Yeah, it's no good.
So.
So, other characters.
There are about a billion other characters in this book. I think there are 30-plus chapters, and pretty much every chapter is a different character, supposedly.
Yeah, not all of them are actually about the people in the chapter title, but we're going to list a bunch of them. Many of them really just exist to have one trait, and presumably are supposed to illustrate some facet of this story, though with a couple of them it's kind of hard to see exactly how. So, well, first on our list is Nate Lee, who kind of triggers the last sequence of events, really.
Yeah, he's
a young rich kid, basically.
Thank you. Yeah. I was trying to think of the word wealthy and could not for some reason. He comes from a wealthier family. He's in love with a prostitute in Rome who never gets a name, is just referred to as Nate Lee's whore.
Yep.
Completely in love with her. She doesn't give two shits about him till toward the end of the book. Turns out all she needed was a good night's sleep.
I did enjoy that little story, actually.
He ends up getting involved in a meteor collision and dies toward the end of the book. And then when Yossarian goes to tell this woman that he's dead, she spends the rest of the book trying to kill him.
Yeah, like, it seemed like that crazy fit of lashing out when she got the news, except then she kept following him around.
Like, she sneaked onto the plane back to Pianosa and tried to kill him, and then he, like, parachuted her off over Rome, and she came back another time, and then at the very end of the book, she jumps in and tries to kill him right before he runs off.
She successfully stabs him at one point.
Yeah, she does.
It was very silly.
Yeah, it's kind of messed up.
Yeah, it was. And Yossarian was trying really hard not to be killed, but also trying really hard not to severely injure her in escaping.
Uh-huh.
Which is probably more than I would have done.
I know.
That bitch would be crazy.
He got fed up a couple times and punched her, but... Yeah. we have Orr. O-R-R.
His crazy like a fox tent mate.
Yeah, so... Well, I guess the first thing about him is that his cheeks are really big.
Yeah.
Because he used to shove horse chestnuts in there when he was a kid.
Right. And carry crab apples. So people wouldn't ask him about the horse chestnuts, because he always had crab apples.
Or he would put crab apples in there.
Or he'd put the crab apples in there.
I was like, how do you put crab apples in your mouth?
And he was always tinkering with the stuff in their tent. Apparently their tent had, like, the biggest badass stove.
Like, heating and air conditioning and everything.
And kind of acted like a single-minded idiot. Mm-hmm. Like, there was an incident with a prostitute hitting him over the head with a shoe, and he was always, "Huh, you want to hear about that? I'll tell you if you let me put horse chestnuts in my cheeks," and then they couldn't understand anything he said.
Yeah.
And finally, at the end, Yossarian realizes, oh, Orr was acting like an idiot. Oh, and his plane crashed on every mission, too.
Yeah, every single mission is plane crash, so...
But it crash-landed safely every time. Uh-huh. Or at least the crew was safe every time. And so it turns out it was all a big practice run, and him acting like an idiot so he could escape.
Yep.
Which he does.
And then he rode his way to Sweden, apparently.
Yes, he rode to Sweden from the Mediterranean... on a rubber life raft. Which is a lot funnier when I say it out loud.
Yeah.
In the book, I just kind of accepted it.
I did like that realization at the end, or kind of annoyed me until the end when they revealed, oh, he was crash landing on purpose to get used to crash landing and all this different stuff. And I was like, okay.
Now I get it.
I'm all right with you, Orr.
Now I get it. McWatt, who likes to buzz the tents, mostly to scare Yossarian.
He reminded me of Tom Cruise from Top Gun.
Yeah, no, it's an inevitable comparison. Which, I can't really remember anything else about him.
He was a friendly guy who liked to fly.
Yeah.
I think he was one of the ones who's actually enthusiastic about flying.
Okay, that's right. Until he accidentally cut a guy in half by buzzing the beach too closely.
Yeah.
And then he flew off and...
Ran into a mountain. And died.
Understandably, felt bad about it.
Yeah, he let the other two guys in the plane parachute out, and then he ran into the mountain.
Yep. Which was why Dr. Nika got cut from the rolls.
Yeah.
Because he was on the plane, but didn't parachute out of the plane. But he was standing right there in his tent the whole time, and was alive and well, and talking to the person who was evicting him from his tent because he was dead.
Yep. Yeah, so Dr. Nika got put on the plane roster... because he wanted to get his flying hours, but didn't actually want to be in the plane.
He was afraid of flying.
Mm-hmm. And then the two guys parachuted out, and the plane crashed and burned, and they all said, well, he was on the roster, but he didn't parachute out, so he has to be dead. Even though he keeps protesting. And they send his wife a letter saying he's dead, and then he sends her a letter saying he's not, and she tries to write him back, and it gets returned because he was killed in combat.
Right.
And all this other crazy stuff.
More perfect examples of the type of stuff that happens in this book all the freaking time. A flight surgeon who's afraid of flying, and who the Air Force knows is afraid of flying, but puts him there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then declared dead because he was on the roster of the plane, even though he's standing right there, arguing that he is very much alive.
Yep.
Well, there's Milo, the mastermind who... like I said, runs the entire European theater from both sides.
Milo Minderbender.
Minderbender, that was a good last name for him.
M&M.
Yes.
Enterprises, which just stands for Milo and Minderbender.
Right, the ampersand was put there to make it seem like more than one person was running it.
He is the leader of many various towns. He's like a shah and a duke and a whatever else.
Yeah.
And he basically apparently buys every single consumer good in Europe and then somehow sells it back to himself and then sells it back to himself. And then sells it.
And becomes a man of great influence.
And wealth.
And wealth, right.
I don't know.
Because it all goes to the syndicate, but that's okay because everyone gets a share.
And he is also so syndicate-minded that he... does some pretty douchey things. Like when he gets paid by the Germans to defend the bridge, but then he gets paid by the Allies to bomb the bridge.
Yeah.
And since both of those things contradict each other, he basically just stands there and lets them fight the battle and then
pocketing the cash, yeah.
He also drops bombs on his own encampment to make a deal.
Yep.
Which was the shittier part. And we'll get completely distracted by any mention of any sorts of goods.
Yeah, there's a chapter where Yossarian and Hungry Joe, I think, are flying around with him, though I'm not entirely clear on why, in hindsight. And they keep not getting hotels and basically not sleeping and living for days in horrible conditions while every time they try to talk to Milo, he hears about some new rumor and goes off to buy up whatever commodity was rumored about.
Right, he says, oh, okay, okay, I have you guys a hotel, you can sleep here. And then he goes, Clementines?
Yeah.
What? And like runs off, and then they immediately get kicked out.
When he's using his influence to help Yossarian find the Nately's whore's little sister, and is talking to the policeman who mentions that the police are all busy because they're trying to hunt down these illegal tobacco smugglers, and as soon as he says those words, Yossarian's like, oh, shit.
Yeah. Illegal tobacco?
He's like, no, Milo, come back. Come back to me, buddy.
And then he just runs off.
It's like,
up.
Illegal tobacco. God, sprint.
Yep.
Sigh.
Milo, you dick. He started pissing me off.
Okay, Dunbar, actually, was one of my favorite characters early on. Just because his philosophy was ridiculous. He liked everybody that he hated.
Uh-huh.
Because it made the subjective time seem longer. So his goal was to live as long as he possibly could by basically hating his life, yes. So it went by slowly.
Doing tons of things that he hated. Yeah, they were talking about shooting
Shooting Skeet?
Yeah, shooting Skeet. And Dunbar hated it, so naturally he loved it.
Or Dunbar liked such and such because he hated him.
Yeah. Oh, Dunbar. Was he the one who got disappeared?
I believe so.
Okay.
He was kind of Yossarian's chief partner in crime for the first half of the book. He was the one that was in the hospital with him and several times, apparently.
Pretending to be other people.
Yeah, the second go around.
That scene was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Screw.
Yeah. Colonel Cathcart, who keeps raising the missions because he wants to be noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And obsessively wonders whether his status is going up or down because he wants to be a general.
Yeah, is it a black eye or a feather in his cap?
Yes.
Those are the twos.
And Lieutenant Colonel Korn, who...
Colonel Korn.
Yeah, Colonel Korn. is just a backstabbing, rank-rising weasel.
Yeah. He's trying to undermine Cathcart so he can raise up in the ranks himself.
Ex-PFC and later ex-corporal and later ex-sergeant Wintergreen. He's all the way up to ex-sergeant. Who's a mail clerk on the mainland and runs, like, the entire military operation on the Allied side just by deciding which mail goes where.
Yeah. If he doesn't like someone, then he just doesn't send their mail.
And he sends promotions and denies promotions. Yeah. Like, General Peckham gets cut almost entirely out of the command loop for a while because Wintergreen said his prose was too prolix.
Yeah. Was he the one who made the T.S. Eliot call?
Yes.
To Peckham?
He was.
T.S. Eliot.
Slam. What was that? And then there's a whole circle of high-ranking officers calling other high-ranking officers and just saying T.S. Eliot. And hanging up. So ridiculous.
That was pretty funny.
That was pretty funny. But that happened in the first 100 pages?
Yeah.
The chaplain, who is not a woman, but Yossarian, did immediately fall in love with.
That's the first sentence.
Yes, the opening sentence of the book. It's like, oh, strong start.
LGBT month coming.
Yeah.
The chaplain, this poor guy, is kind of spineless. I think he's more sane than the other ones, and he just doesn't know how to deal with the insanity. Because people are just constantly confusing the hell out of him. But he's trying to get these men out of flying these missions after talking to them and just not being able to deal with the people in charge.
Yeah, and then his aide is undermining him and
at every step.
At every step. And kind of, well, I guess it kind of emotionally abusing him, though the chaplain could keep that from happening if he would just have a spine for a minute.
Yeah.
So a little bit of that he brings on himself. But at the end of the book, he seems all fired up. Though we don't know if he actually follows through. That being said.
Yeah, he goes through this huge crisis of darkness, and I don't know what I believe in, and he's always terrified his wife and kids are dying horribly back home, and he's pretty fucked up for a while. But, yeah, he finally seems to gain his purpose at the end, but...
Yep. Nate Lee's horror we already talked about. She needed sleep, was disinterested in Nate Lee, and was murderous when he died.
Yep.
And that's about all we know.
Yep.
General Peckham, who really wants General Dreedle's post, and General Dreedle, who doesn't give a shit about anything. And then Scheisskopf, who was in charge of training a lot of the pilots, who later pops up as an aide to Peckham and then gets promoted over his head.
Yep. He's obsessed with parades for some reason, and his main job under Peckham is to cancel parades that they never scheduled.
Right. he seems... I'm guessing that someone who is... spent time in the military probably sees certain archetypes of high-ranking officers, and probably all three of these generals fit into certain ones of those. I don't have any intimate experience with that, but I could imagine Dreedle as he's basically the bellicose moron who just likes to shout and have authority but not do anything with it, and Peckham is the guy who just wants to add another star and get more authority because it makes him look cooler. And Scheisskopf is a guy who's just obsessed with appearances and parade ground stuff and nothing that actually matters.
Mm-hmm. I liked Peckham's bomb formation thing.
The bomb cluster thing?
Yeah.
Because it makes for nicer aerial photographs.
He wants to have nice aerial photographs. It doesn't actually matter, but everyone's obsessed with it now.
Actually, on this mission, we should try to spread them out to make the roadblock as long and deep as possible. I don't care about that. It doesn't make a good picture. Sigh.
Hungry Joe, who is okay when he's flying missions, and as soon as he hits the number of missions they have to fly, goes insane.
Yep, until the missions get raised again.
Yep, has horrible nightmares. Cat is sleeping on his face all the time.
Yeah, which suffocates him to death later. Randomly.
Yeah.
For no reason.
They just wanted someone else to die.
He also tries to take pictures of naked women all the time. tries to talk him into it. Sometimes, frequently, apparently, successfully.
Yep.
By telling them he was a big-time photographer who worked for Life magazine, the irony of which is that he was a big-time photographer that worked for Life magazine, which kind of begs the question, why he's not out shooting scenes in the battlefield, because I think that's what most of those guys were doing during that war. But
he either leaves the camera, the cap on, the lens, or
he gets so excited that he basically fucks it up every time.
Every time.
Which is a pretty decent running joke, actually.
Yeah.
Actually, there were one or two scenes where someone was with a woman, and then Hungry Joe's like, hey, what's up, guys? And then they're like, oh, shit, get dressed!
Yeah, the scene with Yosari Henry's, get dressed!
And then goes and blocks the door just in time. Poor Hungry Joe. Arfie, who is maybe the biggest shithead in the book.
Yep.
Basically just acts really upsetting whenever they're on a mission, and then just says, I can't hear you, no matter what they say. And Yossarian's like pummeling him with his fists, and he's just laughing and going, I can't hear you.
Yeah.
It was like, throw him out the door. I'm so tired.
Yeah. And then at the end, he totally rapes and murders a woman.
Oh, yeah. And for some context on that, he's always making a point of ignoring women.
He's too good to sleep with these women, usually.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, whatever, I don't need that.
Dude, you raped her. I've never paid for it. The MPs, you threw out the window and killed her. The MPs are coming for you. And then they bust into the room and drag Yossarian away for being absent without leave.
Yeah.
Which was sick. Chief Halfoat, drunk.
He's a Native American, and his goal is to die of pneumonia.
Which he succeeds in. That was actually pretty good. As soon as he heard of it, he decided he was going to die of it.
Yep.
And then spent a few months doing so, from the sounds of things. But did eventually succeed.
He did.
Snowden, who got basically ripped in half by Flak.
Mm-hmm. He's the guy who didn't get to fully join the squadron because he had to fly a mission right away.
Mm. Major. Okay, so his name is Major, and his rank is Major, which makes him Major.
His dad's basically a dickbag.
Yeah. And Wintergreen, I think, wasn't responsible for promoting him, right? He was, like, promoted on accident or something like that.
Someone promoted him, and then Wintergreen refused to change his rank.
Because the army needed a Major. Which is very silly. Also, Wintergreen again. Corporal Wickham.
I couldn't remember how to spell his name.
He was
the chaplain.
Yeah, we talked about him and Danica already.
Yep.
All right.
So characterization. As you noticed, we were able to run through the characters pretty fast. Most of them do not really have any real development, with the exception of Yossarian, who gains most of his in the last chunk of the book. Yossarian does finally start to feel like an authentic person as opposed to just a wacky character in this crazy book.
Yeah, he's, like, honestly concerned about things and talking about the world in a, like, way that has at least some basis in reality. And debates, despite it being slightly silly, debates pretty cogently with Major Dansby.
Mm-hmm.
Who we didn't mention, he's the operations officer, and the chaplain, about whether it's okay for him to run away, given his circumstances.
And, like Ben was saying, the generals, who are probably all leadership archetypes, all the guys in charge are like that. None of them are supposed to be real characters, because they're all just there to show the purpose that the people in charge of the war are all concerned with stupid shit that has nothing to do with the men fighting the war. Which leads us to one of our main issues of the book, Ben.
War is bad.
War is bad and bureaucracy is stupid.
War is bad, I think, is actually the theme of every war novel. Or war movie.
Yeah.
Except possibly 300.
Well, that doesn't really count.
I'm not sure that's actually a war movie. That's more of a comic book.
Yeah.
But, yes, war, guess what, is hell. So, I guess that's not a surprise to anybody.
It is surprising how many people we mentioned dying, and I don't think we mentioned everyone who died, that the book starts off so goofy, and then by the end of it, almost all the enlisted guys that are Yossarian's friends are dead.
Yeah, and a couple of them pretty graphically.
Uh-huh.
In Snowden's death scene, I think there was the purpose of that being so graphic, though, is to help us understand why Yossarian was half crazy.
Uh-huh. And Kid Samson getting chopped in half by the plane was pretty
messed up. Like, he didn't just get chopped in half. There were some pretty thorough descriptions of his
bits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his rotting legs that no one would pick up because they were scared of them.
Yeah.
And then bureaucracy just throughout, starting with the very title, Catch-22, because, you know, just regulations that don't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
A dead man staying in Yossarian and Orr's tent because he's not on the roster, so he can't be removed from the roster.
Mm-hmm.
Doc Danica being dead because he was on the flight, but not actually on the flight.
The couple interrogation scenes they have are out of control.
Yeah, there's just a big old loop. Bureaucracy is stupid, which anyone who's waited in line for 4 hours at the DMV can attest to.
Woo!
Sexual issues. Lots of prostitutes.
Most of their interactions with women involve prostitution.
Yeah, actually, in general, the attitude of the servicemen towards women is pretty deplorable.
Yeah. And it's reflected in the fact that, you know, most of the women don't have names.
Yep.
The nurses, we have Nurse Duckett and Nurse Kramer, and I think they even get first names mentioned briefly, like Marianne and Sue Ann, I think is Duckett. I don't remember the other one.
Yeah.
But even they're treated pretty shitty. Like, one of the first scenes with Nurse Duckett involves Yossarian, like, pawing at her crotch and her, like, backing up, and then Dunbar grabbing her chest and her backing up from him, and then just pinballing and getting sexually assaulted.
Yeah.
Which is supposed to be funny.
I guess, as far as I can tell. It was kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Lots of... women in this book are essentially objects.
Yes.
They're frequently referred to as such.
Yeah, that was the one thing I was going to mention, is that Nurse Duckett does actually get a little bit of characterization, because she and Yossarian kind of carry on a brief fling.
Mm.
But, like, the first thing he describes about her is, like, how hot she is.
Right. Yeah.
Like, that's women's purpose, is essentially to be sex objects.
Yep.
So.
And occasionally described in ways that are slightly off-putting. There's lots of rapiness in this book.
Yeah.
There's some that's kind of direct, like Arfi or Yossarian walking through Rome, seeing a woman who's clearly getting gang raped by a bunch of servicemen. And just a lot of that going on.
Yeah, or the scene, and this isn't directly rape, but where they have Nate Lee's horror. Like, the commanding officers have her in the hotel room and won't let her go.
Oh. Because they're telling her to say uncle, and she keeps doing it.
Yeah.
Again, catch 22.
Yeah. And I don't think they're really doing anything to her, but again, like, they're locking her up and not letting her go. And right. Everyone's naked, so that's kind of awkward.
Kind of weird.
Yeah. Again, war stories in general tend to be bad about portrayals of women.
That's true.
As anything other than prostitutes or, like, honorable wives back home.
Right.
So, but, yeah, not great.
And so I guess, are there...
plot points we haven't touched on?
The Washington Irving joke, I guess.
That one was fairly amusing.
It was pretty good. So Yossarian, during his hospital stay, since he's a captain, one of the jobs of wounded officers is to censor mail. And he was signing his name as Washington Irving. And when that got boring, Irving Washington.
And he was censoring the mail, like, not the way he was supposed to. He's like, this time I'm going to take out all the articles.
Yeah, that was pretty silly.
This time I'm going to... One time he just blacks out the entire letter except for the salutation and then signs it with the chaplain's name.
Right. And then the...
Major.
I guess basically the internal affairs, the CID guys, are looking for the person doing it. And that gives Major the idea of starting to do it on all of his documents.
Uh-huh.
It keeps all that paperwork from coming back to him.
Yep.
That was part of that, too. The paperwork would always go through, like, 5 other desks and come back to him to sign again with another attachment on it. And just keep going through all these circles. Except when he started signing Washington Irving or Irving Washington to them, then they'd go away.
And then John Milton.
And then John Milton. And Milton John.
And then ultimately the chaplain gets accused of being Washington Irving.
Yes, because he signed his name, except he didn't.
On that letter.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he faked it by writing in someone else's handwriting, I guess. It was nuts.
Oh, the one other thing I did want to mention was when they have to fly this mission on Bologna, all the men are terrified because they hear it's just going to be this horrible thing, and, like, it's raining every day, and so they keep getting ready to go, and then they can't because it's raining, or, like, the weather clears up for a day, but then they have to wait for the runways to dry, and they're just, like, in agony waiting for this to happen. And the night before they're supposed to fly out there, Yossarian creeps over to, like, the official map and moves the bomb line up to show that the infantry has already taken the city so that they won't have to fly the mission. And then when they all wake up the next morning, all the commanding officers go, oh, huh, I guess we took the city in the night. And then they're calling headquarters, and of course we don't have to go on this mission. And it's kind of hilarious.
Yes. And then, if I recall, when they actually do make a run on Bologna, finally, it's a milk run.
Uh-huh.
There's no problem at all.
Because Yossarian purposely finds something wrong with the plane so they don't have to fly there.
Oh, well, yeah, Yossarian didn't even go.
Yep.
Yeah. So they go, intercom's broken, can't fly. Themes we hit, points of interest. So really just a couple of more jokes.
Yeah.
That we liked. And we left one off the list that I remembered. Major DeCoverly,
whose
first name is a dash because everyone's too intimidated by his appearance to ask him what his first name is.
About him, yeah.
I kind of enjoyed that concept, at least.
And he goes into all the cities to get apartments for
the men. And somehow he always manages to be at the vanguard of the forces parading through the newly taken city. We're not entirely sure how.
Yep.
But there was the... Okay, so the one joke in this book that made me laugh out loud was Yossarian freaking out about something he invented called the LePage glue gun, which is apparently like a 300-millimeter cannon that fires a glue missile that can glue a whole formation of planes together right in midair. And he's flipping out about this, and Colonel Korn says, "Shut up, you're crazy, don't do that." And then, like, not a half a page later, he's telling people to watch out for the LePage glue gun, which can glue an entire formation of planes together right in midair.
It's just a really funny visual.
Yes, it is.
And then for Major Major, he is so humiliated by all sorts of crap. He's messed up. He decides that he doesn't want to see anybody at all anymore. And so the guy who sits outside his office, he can never let anyone in when he's in his office. And then when he leaves, then people are allowed to go in. But then when he shows up again, they have to leave and wait for him.
Right. You can see the Major, but only when he's not here.
Yeah.
Another catch 22.
Yep. So strengths and weaknesses of the writing. There's obviously a strong satirical tone that a lot of people have liked about this book because it is a classic.
Yeah, and there is a lot of humor in it, and a lot of it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I think he does a really good job of creating a tone of the novel in the opening part of it. And I liked the ending because stuff was happening.
Yes, there was a little bit of a through plot.
We're growing slightly. The middle is... tough.
Ben and I both had a really hard time getting through the book. We think the main reason is just because there really is no narrative until the end. You do have all these events that kind of go together to explain stuff, but it jumps around so much and is so off-kilter that you sometimes don't even know what's happening.
Yeah.
And it makes it hard to read a lot of it at a time, because none of it seems to really fit together.
Yeah, it was really tough to go more than a chapter or two at a time, because you'd read 20 pages of contradictory silliness, and then start a new chapter, and it'd be more contradictory silliness, and you just go, I don't know what's happening, and I don't really care, even though when we're talking about the book, like, in hindsight, I'm enjoying some of these jokes a little more saying them out loud, even than just reading them. Because there is a lot of pretty funny stuff in there. It's just not presented in a way where it's easy to keep taking it in.
Yeah, I was just getting bored, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I counted pages in this book more than...
Yeah, haven't...
How much do I have left?
And, I haven't force read like this in a little while. So,
it does have relevance, like we said. It's a really important war novel for this past century, especially considering the more modern flavor of warfare, tied up in bureaucracy and the Korea and Vietnam quagmires. But, that's really, I think, why it is a classic.
Yeah, I feel a little sorry for someone who has to study it, because studying a book frequently turns it into a slog. Mm-hmm. Especially when you have to do it in high school and there's a bullshit curriculum the teacher has to stick to. Whether they have the ability to make it interesting or not. They certainly aren't allowed to do so within their own frame of reference most of the time.
I'm actually a little surprised that some people in my class read this in high school. Some of it seems a little mature. You'd think, like, parents might be like, there's too much prostitution in this
book. No, I'm sure they do, but they'd have to read it to know,
I guess.
Questions. I have a few questions, actually.
Yeah.
Does Yusarian make it to Sweden?
Yeah, he's determined to follow Orr out there.
Does he rescue Natalie's Horror's little sister? He said he was going to.
Yeah, he wants to.
Does Milo's syndicate actually work? I feel like this is a stupid question.
Ben and I cannot figure this out.
I just have this gut feeling. I probably should have looked it up, but, you know, it goes against everything I believe in. The crazy system he has of selling the eggs is actually related to something that happens in the market, and I just don't know the name of that thing. It's got to be a thing.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll remember to look it up this week. If I do, I'll probably forget about it before I can tell you guys. How the hell will they make a movie of this?
Yeah, I looked it up because one of my coworkers said, oh, there's a movie of that. And I went, what? You know, sometimes they talk about books being unfilmable, and then, of course, they always get movies made of them.
Yeah.
I seriously think this book is unfilmable. I don't know how there's a movie of it.
It almost feels like it could be an hour-long sketch comedy that airs every week. I don't know, but I don't know how you would make a movie out of it.
There is one. Ben and I kind of want to watch it just to see what the hell they did.
I'm really curious to see what they did and whether it's easier to digest or whether it just comes across as stupid and confused.
Yeah.
So, I think that's it. Our verdict.
Verdict.
I'm glad I know it. I didn't particularly enjoy reading it. I honestly probably wouldn't recommend you go read it unless you're just one of those people who has to devour every classic.
Yeah, I would not. I can say safely I would not have finished it if I hadn't had to for the podcast. I stopped enjoying it and just kind of slogged through. And yeah. I liked the end pretty well. I liked it better than a lot of the middle, but
it was tough.
Yeah. Unless that's your thing, I would not necessarily recommend it.
Yeah. So what you reading right now?
I just started reading The Perilous Guard by Mary Elizabeth Warren. It was written in the 70s or 80s. I actually won a Newbery Award.
Does someone die?
No.
Amazing.
That's the thing. I've read this book like a billion times because it's set in the 1500s. I just love it.
A favorite.
Yeah.
Okay. I am reading Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries with a subtitle that I can't pull out of my head for some reason by Ken Fader, who is a professor of archaeology who, as I know from a podcast that we both listen to, is also rather foul-mouthed and hilarious. But it's basically a book about how to do good archaeology and how to see through all of the frauds, hoaxes, and myths that are out there.
Yeah, he started it because he was teaching a class. He was a new professor, and he was teaching an intro class, and he wanted to be cool and the kids help write the syllabus.
Yeah.
What do you guys want to learn about? And everyone's saying stuff like, ancient aliens!
Right.
And then he said, yeah, okay. And so
we can work with this.
He teaches about how all the ancient alien astronaut crap is really stupid.
Right, how if you examine it scientifically, there is no leg to stand on whatsoever. Yep. It's a really interesting book, and actually I'm learning about some fringe nutty theories that I'd never even heard of before, which is kind of fun. And
yeah.
Learning a couple things about actual history that I hadn't learned before, which is even more fun.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, basically I'm nerding out.
I'm borrowing it when you're done.
Yes, you are.
So, if you would like to leave us a comment, you can do so at our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
Or you can email us, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
You can find us on Twitter at novelideaspod.
And we are on iTunes, where if you listen to us there, you should rate, review us and stuff and help people find the show.
Stuff and junk.
Yeah.
So next week, we are kind of doing an LGBT theme. It's more of a gender exploration than actual focus on LGBT issues.
Right. A little bit of a gender bender premise.
But we're trying to embrace the theme.
Yeah, so it's The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin, who is a golden era 1960s science fiction writer who is still alive and fairly old at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But someone who is writing concurrently with, if not necessarily in the same stage of her career with, Bradbury and Heinlein and Clarke and Asimov. She's a little later than them.
She's won some awards. And
she's a Hugo winner.
And is a female science fiction author.
And is known for at least having some feminism in her works. She should be a very different flavor of classic science fiction than
other things
Asimov heard. And Clarke, yeah. For sure. So, I'm looking forward to it. I read one of her other books when I was way too young to understand the themes in it, so I honestly don't have an opinion of her yet.
All I know is all of her people have weird names, but apparently she pulls it off okay, so.
Yeah. Making them good characters, no doubt.
Instead of the mediocre fiction where they're just like, oh, it's fantasy, so they have weird names.
Blark and Glog went to the space tavern.
Yeah, great.
This is going to be good.
Oh, God.
So, anyway, I think that does it for this week.
Yeah.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.